All right, so are you ready to tackle a case today that really kind of makes you scratch your head? It's one of those where like art and the world of trademark law, they kind of bump into each other.
They collide.
Yeah. And to make it even more interesting, this all went down in the arena of college football. Big stakes.
Absolutely. And what I think is so interesting about this case, University of Alabama v. New Life Art, is how it just so clearly shows the tension between the right of an artist to express themselves and a university's really, really strong desire to protect their brand.
Yeah, you know, I think when people think about trademark law, they think it's like pretty simple, right? Like just don't slap a logo on a t-shirt or something. But this case really shows us it's way more complicated than that.
Oh, yeah, it's not that simple.
It gets into these really deep questions about like literally what you can and cannot depict.
Absolutely. I think it kind of forces us to ask this question, like, can you trademark history itself? Like, is that even possible?
Yeah, and if so, where do you even draw the line? Like how do you even begin to figure that out? Okay, so let's try to break this down a bit. We've got Daniel Moore. He's an artist who loves to paint those big iconic moments from Alabama football history. But then on the other side, we've got the University of Alabama, and they're saying, whoa, 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 those crimson and white uniforms, those are ours, and you need our permission if you're going to paint them. It's like a real clash of the Titans.
It is a clash of the titans, and I think the implications of this case go way beyond just this one artist and this one university. I mean, you think about it, this could affect filmmakers, authors, musicians, video game developers, like anyone who uses trademarks that we all recognize in their creative work.
So let's back up a minute and talk about Daniel Moore. What's his story?
So Daniel Moore is actually a graduate of the University of Alabama.
Okay.
So he's got a really deep connection to the school and especially the football program. He actually started painting scenes from Alabama football games back in 1979.
Wow.
And it seems like he was really driven by just a love of the sport and wanting to preserve those amazing moments.
Yeah. His paintings are amazing. You can almost hear the crowd when you look at them.
They're very powerful. You feel the energy of the game. But here's where things get a little messy. From 1991 to 1999, Moore had licensing agreements with the university,
Okay.
and these agreements let him use some of Alabama's trademarks on certain products.
So everyone was getting along.
Well, not quite. Those agreements, they didn't cover every single possible way to use those trademarks. So while he was following the rules for certain merchandise, he was also selling other artwork with those Crimson Tide uniforms, and he didn't have a specific license for that.
Oh, I see where this is going. Trouble's brewing.
Exactly. In 2002, the university decided they'd had enough. They stepped in and they said, nope, those uniforms are our trademark and you need our permission to use them in any way, shape, or form.
Wow, so everything changed. So what did Moore do? Did he just give up?
No, he fought back. He argued that what he was doing was depicting history, not trying to rip off the university and make money off their brand. This is where it gets really interesting, legally speaking. Can you trademark history itself?
It's a great question. It's like, where do you even start to draw a line? How do you even answer that question?
It's tricky. And that's exactly what the courts had to figure out. The university felt like their brand was being infringed upon and they were serious about protecting it. So in 2005, they sued Moore. They claimed he had breached his contract and that he was violating trademark law, specifically the Lanham Act.
Okay, so now we've got a full-blown legal battle. What happened next? What went down in the courtroom?
So the first round took place in the district court, and the decision they came to it was actually kind of split, which I think just goes to show how complicated this whole situation is. When it came to Moore's paintings and prints, the court sided with him. They said those were protected speech under the First Amendment.
Right, so round one goes to the artist.
At least for the paintings and the prints, yeah. But then for what the court called mundane products, things like mugs and calendars, the court sided with the university. They thought these items were more about making money than expressing art.
Interesting. So the court was drawing a line between the art itself and the way it's being used.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. And that difference ended up being like a key part of this whole case. But of course, it doesn't end there. Both Moore and the university, they both wanted a clearer decision. So they both appealed and took the whole thing to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals.
And that's where things get really interesting, right? What were the big questions everyone was waiting for the court to answer?
Okay, so there were two big things the 11th Circuit had to figure out. First, did Moore's art actually violate the university's trademark? And second, did those earlier licensing agreements actually start him from using the uniforms in any way, even in his art? Remember those agreements? They were for specific things?
Right. And it seems like whatever they decided could have a huge impact not only on artists, but on any business or anyone who wants to protect their trademarks.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So what did the 11th Circuit decide? Well, buckle up, because their decisions on both of those questions were pretty groundbreaking. They really shook things up in the world where art and trademark law meet.
Come on, don't leave us hanging.
Yeah.
What was the verdict? What did they say?
Okay, so first of all, they ruled that Moore's paintings and prints and even those calendars, they were all protected under the First Amendment. They said that these were forms of artistic expression, not just ways to make money.
Okay, that's a big win for artistic freedom. Mm-hmm. What about those licensing agreements from before? Did the court say those stopped Moore from using the trademarks?
This is where it gets kind of juicy. The court said that those contracts weren't as ironclad as the university thought they were. They found some of the language to be unclear or ambiguous. It didn't explicitly say that Moore couldn't use those iconic uniforms in any way.
Oh, so the devil's in the details. I bet there were a lot of lawyers sweating bullets when they heard that.
Probably. There's a big lesson here for anyone who writes contracts, especially if you're dealing with creative stuff. If you use language that's not clear, it can bite you later. The court made it clear that if there's something in a contract that's vague or unclear, it's usually interpreted in a way that's not good for the person who wrote it.
And in this case, that would be the university.
Right. But wait, we're not done yet. Remember those mugs that the lower court called mundane products? What happened to those?
Yeah, they seem to have gotten lost in the shuffle.
Well, here's the thing. Moore's lawyers, they didn't really make a strong argument about the First Amendment and those mugs when they went to the appeals court. So the 11th Circuit, they said, okay, we need more discussion on this one, and sent that part of the case back down to the lower court.
So we end on a cliffhanger. It sounds like this case had a lot of layers to it. What was the 11th Circuit's reasoning? Why did they decide the way they did?
Yeah, there's a lot going on. One of the big things the court used was something called the Rogers test.
Okay, you know, legal jargon is not really my thing. Can you bring that down for us normal folks? What is the Rogers test and why was it so important here?
Sure. The Rogers test is basically like a tool that courts use to figure out if someone's use of a trademark is okay or not. They're trying to balance the right to free speech with the rights that come with owning a trademark. So they have to decide if someone's using a trademark in a way that's relevant to their art, or if they're just being sneaky and trying to trick people into thinking a brand is behind something when it's not.
So it's about context, I guess. Like, if you're making a movie about basketball, you could show Nike shoes without getting their permission. But if you just randomly stick a big Nike logo on a spaceship in a sci-fi movie, that's probably not okay.
Yeah, that's a great way to think about it. It's like the whole point of the Rogers test. And in Moore's case, the court, they said that using those Alabama uniforms, it made sense for his art. He wasn't trying to, like, trick people or make money off the university's fame. He needed to use those exact designs and colors to show those historic football moments accurately.
Right, that makes sense. But the court used the Rogers test for everything, right? So how come the calendars were protected, but the mugs got sent back to the lower court?
Yeah.
They both have the uniforms on them.
It all comes down to how the court saw each thing. With the calendars, they were like, these aren't just merchandise. They thought of them more like a collection of art with a different painting for each month.
Like little mini art galleries.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. But with the mugs, they were just like, nope, those are just everyday things. They didn't have that same artistic feeling.
So even though it's the same trademarks, it matters how they're used.
Exactly. It's not just about the what. It's about the how and the why. Oh, and there's another really important point that came out of this case. Something that's especially important for artists and anyone who creates stuff. The court, they made a big deal out of saying that just because someone might think the university was behind Moore's work, that wasn't enough to say he couldn't do it.
Wait, so you're saying just because someone might be confused, that doesn't mean an artist can't express themselves? That seems like it's really hard for companies to win these cases.
It is. And that's something huge for anyone making art that uses trademarks. The court basically said that just the possibility of someone being confused on its own, that's not enough to stop free speech.
Wow, that's a big deal. So what does all this mean for artists and companies and anyone with a trademark? What's the big takeaway here?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that this case really protects artistic expression, especially when someone's using a trademark in a way that's, like, really connected to their art and not trying to fool anyone.
So artists can relax a little.
I think so. Yeah. This decision, it gives artists some space to work with, you know? They can use things from popular culture and put them in their work. But there's another side to this, too. The case also tells companies and universities that they need to be really, really careful when they're writing contracts. No more being vague. If they want to control exactly how their trademarks are used, they got to spell it out super clearly.
So a win for artistic freedom, but also a wake-up call for brands to get their legal stuff in order.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a win for free expression, but it's not a free pass for everyone. You know, there are still rules.
It sounds like this case answered some questions, but it also left us with some new ones.
Definitely. It didn't really give us a perfect definition of what's art and what's just a product, especially now with things like digital art and NFTs. It's getting harder and harder to tell the difference.
Right. Like, where does a picture on a computer become something you're selling?
It's a tough one. This case makes us think hard about these definitions, and it makes you wonder how these legal ideas would work with new types of art and technology.
Okay, now I'm really thinking about this. This case was decided back in 2009, way before anyone was talking about AI art. It makes me wonder what happens when machines start making art that uses famous trademarks.
That's a really interesting question. I think that's one of the big mysteries that came out of this case. Hmm. Does art made by AI have the same First Amendment protections as art made by humans? And how do you even decide if a trademark is relevant when it's an algorithm that's making the art?
It's like this case opened a whole new can of worms. It makes you wonder if our laws are even ready for these questions about artificial intelligence and creativity.
I think it's a conversation we need to start having now. We can't wait until these things end up in court. We need to be thinking about it ahead of time.
Yeah, we need to be proactive, not reactive. This case that seemed so simple about an artist who loved football, it really made us think about the future of art and technology and the law.
For sure. It shows us that the law, it has to change along with the world. And who knows what new questions and challenges are going to come up in the next 10 years.
Well, after all this, I think we all need a minute to think about everything we just learned.
Yeah, me too. It's been a wild ride through the legal system.
It really makes you think about how intellectual property law, you know, it can seem kind of boring and technical.
Right.
But it's actually really connected to some pretty big questions about freedom of speech and creativity and what art even is.
Absolutely. And this case, I mean, it started with just paintings about football.
Right.
But it ended up dealing with so much more than that. Like the balance of power between regular people and big institutions and the role of technology in art and how ownership works in the digital age. I mean, huge questions.
Yeah, it's like a reminder that even a case about something really specific can have these big ripple effects and make us think about the kind of society we want to live in.
And you know what's crazy is that this case was decided like over 15 years ago.
Wow.
And the things it brings up are even more relevant now than they were back then.
It's almost like Daniel Moore was ahead of his time. You know, he accidentally started this whole debate about AI art and NFTs and the metaverse that we're having now.
It really makes you wonder how this case would go down today with all the changes in technology and how art and business work these days.
Right. Would those calendars still be considered art if they were digital files sold as NFTs? Or would they be seen as just products? And what about art made by AI that copies the style of famous artists? Does that count as artistic relevance under the Rogers test?
It's a lot to think about, and honestly, I don't know the answers, but I think that's what makes this case so interesting. It's not just a simple legal rule. It's a starting point for these bigger conversations about how law, technology, and creativity all fit together.
I think it's safe to say we've all got more questions than answers after this deep dive, which I think is a good thing. It means we're really thinking about this stuff.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely made me rethink some things I thought I knew about intellectual property law. It's not just about protecting companies and their money. It's about protecting the right of artists to express themselves and engage with the world.
And for anyone listening who's like, this is all interesting, but I'm not an artist or a lawyer, so why should I care?
Mm-hmm.
I think this case has something for everyone, no matter what you do or how much you like football.
Totally. This case is about way more than trademarks and football. It's about a basic human right to create, to express ourselves, to be a part of our culture. And it reminds us that those rights are always changing, especially as the world changes.
So the next time you see a painting or a sculpture or whatever that uses a brand or a logo, or you hear about a legal fight over intellectual property, remember this case. It reminds us that sometimes it's hard to tell where art ends and business begins, and that the law is always trying to catch up with the world.
Yeah, it's a reminder that we need to pay attention, stay involved, and keep asking those tough questions. Because the answers, they're going to shape the future of how we create and come up with new ideas.
Well, on that note, I think it's time to wrap up this deep dive. But the conversation doesn't have to end here. We hope you'll keep thinking about these things, keep asking questions, and keep those brains working. Because, as we've seen today, sometimes the most interesting legal cases come from the most unexpected places, like a football field in Alabama.
Thanks for joining us on this journey through the world of law and art. Until next time, keep learning, keep questioning, and keep pushing the limits of what's possible.